On this week's 51%, it's that time of year when people are talking about food more than usual. Alice Waters has been talking about food for decades.
We wanted that aliveness of the food. And in following that, we fell into seasonality.
And a jazz and blues singer has another specialty. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Alice Waters is a chef, author, food activist, and the founder and owner of Chez Panisse Restaurant in Berkeley, California. She has been a champion of local sustainable agriculture for more than four decades. In 1995, she founded the Edible Schoolyard Project, which advocates for a free school lunch for all children and a sustainable food curriculum in every public school. She has been vice president of Slow Food International since 2002, and her honors are many. In 2015, she was awarded the National Humanities Medal by President Obama, proving that eating is a political act and that the table is a powerful means to social justice and positive change. Dr. Sharon Ufberg recently caught up with Waters for 51%'s Force of Nature segment. Ufberg begins by asking Waters how her food movement began.
Maybe it began when I was a little girl and grew up in New Jersey, and my parents had a victory garden. I just wrote a memoir called Coming to Your to My Senses. And I looked back to my childhood and realized that I always played outside. And I loved it when summer came around and we were eating corn on the cob from our garden, and we had tomatoes that my father had just the right varietal planted, and we loved those red New Jersey tomatoes. But clearly, I didn't really fall in love with food until I spent a year in France when I was 19, and that was in 1965, and I had an awakening, and I just had never really opened my eyes to the beauty of food in a marketplace, and the way that the French ate with such discrimination and consciousness. And we're wanting just that vegetable at that time of the year. We're very, very picky about what they chose and how they ate.
So you came back to the U.S. What year was that you came back, and when did you open Chez Panisse?
Well, I came back in 1966. And I wanted to live like the French. I mean, truly. So I knew it was about food, and I started cooking at home. But at that time, I was also an assistant in a Montessori school. I taught there for a couple of years, and I went to London for a year in 1968 to learn Montessori education. And that was a very important year of cooking and thinking about food. And when I got back, I just said, maybe I need to open a restaurant. There's no place to eat for my friends.
When you open Chez Panisse, it's very compelling to me that you opened it with some women friends. What inspired you to do that?
I had a number of friends who were very good cooks, who were women friends of mine. And one in particular, Lindsay Shear, who desserts were so delicious. And she was cooking for her family. And I said, oh, Lindsay, if we have a restaurant, would you come and cook the desserts? And she was as naive as I was about opening a restaurant. We thought if we had a group of people who loved cooking, that we could do it. And we never thought about, you know, what it really would take to create a restaurant. We just knew that we, if we only had one menu, that would allow us to, you know, to do what we knew how to do best. And we had no training in the restaurant business. We were home cooks. I mean, I waited on tables, and Lindsay was absolutely without any restaurant experience. We had one person, Paul Arato, who, again, had not worked in a restaurant, but he had the confidence that we lacked at the beginning, and he was just a friend who helped to get it open. But it was in a house, and it felt like we were cooking for our friends.
You actually grew the greens in your backyard and brought them over to the restaurant and washed them and made the salad, correct?
It's true. That was probably happened in the second year when we were looking for that delicious French mesclun salad. And we tried to get people to grow it for us, and ultimately I did plant a garden in my backyard.
So I think it's so fascinating as a woman in the early 70s that you really transcended this very male-dominated field of restaurant life to open this restaurant with some women friends. Can you talk a bit about what inspired you to do that, and what gave you the impetus to do something so bold?
Well, I was part of the free speech movement in Berkeley in 1964. I arrived right at the moment of that very important student demonstration of around free speech, and I was there for the civil rights movement, the women's movement, and I felt really empowered, especially when we stopped the war in Vietnam. And I just thought, if we all get together, we can make this happen. And I really applied that to my own life. I thought I could open a restaurant, and if the food was good, the people would come. I never thought about it. Was I able to do that in a male-dominated industry? It never occurred to me. I just thought that if we had a good idea, that we could work together and really make it happen. And I wasn't seeking out women. It just happened that way, that these are my friends. And they didn't think about it the way men did in terms of the restaurant industry, that we just were cooking like we did at home. I mean, we never had people come in the kitchen early to prepare, do all the prep work, and so that when the chef came in the afternoon, everything would be taken care of. We did that prep work ourselves. We wanted to wash the salad. We wanted to dry it and make the dressing. We wanted to serve it. And it was like a whole process that happened. And we didn't want to waste anything. So we knew how many people we were cooking for when we only had one menu. And now I was remembering when James Beard came to Chez Panisse, and he said, this is not a restaurant. This is cooking at home. This is home cooking. And I love that he said that. But we were looking for taste. we weren't looking for, we weren't trying to follow some recipe at the beginning. We were looking for ingredients that tasted like those that we had tasted in France. We wanted that aliveness of the food. And in following that, we fell into seasonality because that's when the food is the ripest. And so that happened, and we ended up at the doorsteps of the organic local producers, the farmers, the ranchers, because that's what tasted best to us.
Well, I think your connection to the food, to the taste, to the beauty of it, in all of its diversity, really led you to your work as a public policy advocate for school lunch reform and for access to healthy food. I would love for you to share a little bit about some of your dreams around this delicious revolution that you speak of.
So probably it was around the time that I have a child, and I started thinking about what her world would be like, and realized that Chez Panisse in Berkeley couldn't be an island unto itself. And I just believe so much in public education that I started talking about what was going on in terms of food in schools and what were schools teaching our children about the preservation of the natural environment, how were kids learning. And that's how I got involved and really started the Edible Schoolyard Project in a public school in Berkeley back 25 years ago. And it really was connected, of course, with my Montessori learning and my education. I put together that pedagogy of learning by doing to the planting of a garden at a school and the kitchen classroom where children were learning all their academic subjects. But I always had in mind a cafeteria where the students would sit down at tables and eat the food, like the food in a way was coming to Chez Panisse. Not that fancier food, but the organic, real food from local purveyors. And I had that idea right from the beginning. And I'm amazed as what has happened in the last 25 years. Because now, in the state of California, I believe that we are going to be able to serve every single child a free, sustainable school lunch that is where the farmers are connected directly to the schools, and we make that connection to the land.
I know you're working on this dream with the governor of California, and I know you were very also inspirational in helping Michelle Obama get the White House Vegetable Garden. Seeing those children at the White House Vegetable Garden must have been a wonderful thing for you to see.
It was quite amazing to learn that she was going to make a garden right in those first months of Obama taking office, and that she wanted to do it with school children. That image of her digging in the garden with those students went around the world. And I just thought how important it is for public figures to express these values and to really communicate them and demonstrate them in the way that Michelle Obama did by digging in the garden, by actually planting those seeds. And again, it confirms the pedagogy of Maria Montessori of learning by doing. And that engagement is so empowering for the students. They really wake up to the work that they're doing. They learn their math in ways that make it real for them, that they can apply to their own lives. And that's what's so exciting about the Edible Schoolyard Project in Berkeley, that you could have teenagers, that when they go out in the garden, some of them have never experienced a garden. And when they're out there and they're learning math and planting and calculating seeds and eating the raspberries that might be on the bushes, and they are seeing the seeds grow and they get connected in that real way, it's transformational.
I know you have so many other transformational things happening in your own life story. The UC Davis Alice Waters Institute of Edible Education, I guess, is taking your work to the next level, to the college age level, which is very exciting. And in just a couple of years, you'll be celebrating Chez Panisse's 50th anniversary, correct?
Indeed. I hope.
So if you had one piece of advice for people, for women out there listening who love and appreciate the work you're doing, do you have any recommendations for how they might help move this dream of yours forward?
I think that women have just a natural instinct to nourish, and I think we have to use that right now, the idea of taking care of children, of engaging with the people who take care of the land, of taking our children to the farmers market, to taking our family there, to cooking together, is the most important thing that we can do, is to sit down together, all together, to have the children involved with the cooking, to have the fathers and the mothers cooking together is a great beginning of coming back to our human values. I mean, I call it a delicious revolution because it is. It feels good. It's not something difficult to do. I'm always wanting to be outside and in my little tiny vegetable garden and picking herbs. And I know the children love it. And they crave that reconnection to nature.
Thank you so much, Alice. This is Alice Waters from Chez Panisse in California. And this is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
Dr. Sharon Ufberg is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in California. Now we turn to stories from deep in the heart from a Texas Folklife 2019 Institute, where this year's theme was Women in the Austin Music Scene. The story is about musician Connie Jo Kirk, who uses food to share her legacy and love.
East Austin legend Connie Jo Kirk is a chef of many senses. Her jazz vocals have fed the ears of souls for decades, while off the stage, her homemade cooking has filled the mouths of many. Before she was a celebrated, award-winning musician with enough influence to turn down 13 record deals, she was making biscuits in her mother's kitchen at the age of 4.
So I was deaf mute for 2 years. I couldn't play with any kids because I couldn't hear them. I stayed mostly in the house or to myself. But mostly, I would go to the kitchen and watch my mama cook for the family. So I got up on a chair, got up on the counter. My mother used to make homemade rolls. And I kneaded the dough, and she had me to cut them out like biscuit size. And then we would fold them like half shape. But we would put a pat of butter on it, put them in a pan. We'd have some Cristo butter in the pan melted, and we'd roll them in that. And then we'd let them rise. Then she taught me how to make cakes and cookies. She taught me how to cook the meat and make gravy. I think that by the time I was 5, I was making gravy, homemade gravy.
We were invited to her childhood home, first by Connie, and then by the aroma that met us at the door.
And then apple juice.
I was wondering.
Yes, ma'am. You spray it. And this is what you spray. The sugar caramelizes and traps the moisture in there. And it doesn't come out. And when you bite into it, bam. Oh, Lord.
Connie commands the kitchen like she commands the stage, telling jokes and leading the tempo.
Danielle, yeah. What's wrong with your finger? Did you have a stroke or something? You better get your booty over here and help dry them leaves and help me get out of here, girl. Come on, honey. Oh, by the way, I'm Auntie Connie from now. My name is Auntie Connie. Everybody else call me Auntie Connie. You might as well too. See, when I graduate you to Auntie Connie level, that means you get to come over many times, not just once in a while. You get the privilege to call like the others. You just got to beat them calling, though.
Inside, we get a chance to taste a spoonful of her Mango Spitfire barbecue sauce. She's cooking tonight to feed the folks at Skylark Lounge. Connie regularly makes and sells wraps to fund her humanitarian efforts.
This is God's truth. I cook so damn good that I scare myself. And every time I cook for people, I cook for about 40 or 50 friends and family. So I would take food to the club and sit up there waiting to sing. And the bartender said, "What you got there?" I said, "Oh, I just got some ribs with my barbecue sauce on it." "Ooh, can I taste them?" I never get it back. They pass it around. I said, "Wait a minute, that's my food. Give my food back." So then I said, "Okay, I'm going to have to fix everybody. I'm going to have to go on and cook a whole pan." So I became the rib woman.
Connie acknowledges her mother, civil rights leader Willie Mae Kirk, as her teacher and coach, passing on to her a microphone and serving spoon.
And she was soft-spoken, intelligent, and she was kind-hearted, a humanitarian. Mother's main concern was to save the orphans because she was an orphan herself. And she would cook all the time to feed families. And she cooked for all of the widows from World War II that lived on our street.
Connie cooks because she can. And like everything she can do, she does it with love. This story was produced by Elizabeth Maldonado, Taylor Pruitt, and Ezra McPherson, with assistance from Danae Johnson, for Stories from Deep in the Heart, a project of Texas Folklife.
If I say the word drumstick with all the food stories, you're probably going to think of it as something edible. But we'll take a spin on that word and find it means something else to this certain bird.
This is Bird Note. In the music world, it's often said that the drummer never gets the girl. But is that true? Maybe not for wild Australian palm cockatoos. For the first time ever, an animal has been documented making a tool to create music. Male palm cockatoos use their enormous beaks to break off a stick or seed pod from a tree. The bird then fashions it into a sort of drumstick. Clutching the stick in his left foot, he beats on a hollow tree. Most animals that use tools do so to get food. But But these cockatoos seem to do it specifically to create a rhythmic beat designed to impress their potential mates. Drumming is just part of an intricate courtship display. The male cockatoo sways his body, stretches his wings, and erects his long, slender crest feathers, all while producing loud, high-pitched whistles. Not only that, but he blushes. His bare cheek patches turn bright red, contrasting brilliantly with his all-black plumage. As the display continues, he pirouettes on his branch and bobs his head. If the female watching is impressed, she'll join the male on his branch and imitate his movements, swaying, bobbing, and whistling alongside him as he drums. Okay, so maybe this drummer does get the girl. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
California's first-in-the-nation law requiring publicly held companies to put women on their boards of directors faces a second legal challenge. The law requires publicly traded companies to have at least one woman on their boards by year's end. By 2021, boards with five members must have two women. Those with six directors must have three. The Pacific Legal Foundation provided the Associated Press with a lawsuit it filed in federal court November 13th. The libertarian group says the law violates the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution. It wants to block the law in California and other states. Similar proposals had been introduced in Illinois, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Washington State. Another conservative group sued in August, saying spending taxpayer money to enforce the law would violate the California Constitution. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1583.